That's how you play the Hammond Jazz Organ. That's the legendary Shirley Scott laying the foundation for Eddie Lockjaw Davis on tenor sax coming up, and later on Jerome Richardson on flute. This number is titled Skillet. It's from Davis's Cookbook Volume Number 2, released in 1958. George Duvivier on bass and Arthur Edgehill on drums. You've got to get to know these people. The music is just so incredible to me. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, January the 24th. And in the continuing effort to hound Dennis Rodman, we learned today that the U.S. Treasury Department, the State Department, and the Commerce Department are all supposedly investigating him for taking luxury goods into the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, including some bottles of whiskey and vodka and so forth. So we'll get to that next week, but we already discussed what the aim here. By the way, what fueled the discussion, what fueled the investigation are media reports, unquote. Well, today I want to talk about Detroit. This is going to be the first in a series. We'll be deconstructing not just what is happening in Detroit, but the implications for other similarly situated cities. Since the declaration or the application for bankruptcy last year on July the 18th, we've been talking about Detroit, and several people who have been able to give us an authoritative analysis on several levels, historically, sociologically, politically, economically, and also in terms of this entire process being mounted at this time to achieve a specific aim and objective. And it is not lost, and it shouldn't be lost in anyone, that the environment, I always stress the need to see things in context. The environment is that throughout the United States, there is a realignment of interests. And when you marry that with another concept I've been talking about for quite some time, and that is zero-sum thinking, and zero-sum thinking that informs policymaking. The idea is that anything deemed to be a benefit automatically has to be controlled. There can't be enough for everybody. So those in power will arrogate most of it to themselves, and whatever little they are inclined to share, well, people have to duke it out to get their share of whatever is left. But it is important to see Detroit as a harbinger of what cities like New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., all across the nation, where we have these large urban centers with significant populations of color, we will see the domino effect in one way or the other. And already the bankruptcy mantra has been rattling through Chicago already, and Philadelphia, Newark, New Jersey, Trenton, New Jersey, all over the United States, where we find certain commonalities, and they are disturbing, very disturbing. What is this realignment I'm talking about? It is more than just the realignment of the power axis. Of what we consider the traditional power axis, axis is not the only power axis to be concerned about. We are accustomed to talking about it in terms of, you know, the political realm. But a city like Detroit, for example, that has been under African-American leadership at the mayoral level for almost 40 years, from 1974 to just last year, there's a certain thing that you have to look at there that is also occurring in these other cities. There did come a time in these cities where political power, the political will of the disfranchised became real in terms of elected office. You did have people who were heading up the mayoralty of the city. But does that mean that there was commensurate political power? No. These people were elected largely as figureheads. They came into power on the strength and support of African-American and Latino constituencies, mostly, and other smaller groups. But the bulk of the political effort was driven by African-American and Latino constituencies. And they actually had the illusion that elected people would do the right thing and somehow bring about some modicum of justice and equality and fairness in the city. They'll get a fair break because they'd been under the thumb on economic terms for so long. But, of course, a realignment had already occurred. The political power structure that they were looking at that looked like them, black and brown faces, had already signed on to a really horrible program. Their job was not to make any waves. Their job was really to be caretakers, taking orders from the higher authority. Their job simply was to look as if they were in charge. I can tell you directly the case of Mayor Dinkins in the city of New York. Out of Harlem, and Harlem was considered at one time the crucible, the epicenter of black political power in the city of New York. And he came out of Harlem. We don't need to even discuss what Harlem looks like now. But at the helm of the city for those 4 years, you can't really count what exactly were the advantages, what gains were made with his leadership at the helm. And unfortunately, that is a story often repeated across the nation. The leadership looks black. It may look Latino. It may look, quote, progressive, unquote. But when you look a bit deeper and you see what comes out in terms of policies when they are at the helm, there is no question as to where their fidelity lies. Their fidelity is to a party and to a system that actually despises the very constituencies that make it possible for them to have power. In the city of New York, in an expanded city council where African Americans and Latinos together are the dominant representation numerically, at the precise moment that there is a majority, quote, minority presence in the city council, which is the nerve center, the political nerve center and the policymaking nerve center of the city, you have entire communities being just absolutely assaulted by horrible policies. Schools are being shut down. Hospitals are closing. Police brutality is escalating. The prisons are crammed with their sons and increasingly their daughters. There is homelessness. There is poverty at unimaginable proportions. And all these things are well within the purview of the city council, which again has a majority-minority control. So then you ask yourself, what then is this relation? Do we dare continue to make a correlation between black or Latino leadership and the objective conditions under which these constituencies actually have to live day by day. Harlem is Detroit. Philadelphia is Detroit. Newark is Detroit. Trenton is Detroit. These cities with these very significant urban centers of primarily African American and Latino residents, it seems to me, are singled out for a particular kind of treatment. And I really believe in this thing. I've been talking about it. The more I talk about it, the more I believe in this zero-sum way of thinking. They have to regain these neighborhoods. They have to, there's a system that says it is time. America is all about money. It's all about what you're going to get. And who, therefore, can you exploit to get it? Who must you do away with in order to have it? And the bullseye has been in these communities for a very long time. All the way back in the 1980s, I was writing about gentrification and the redlining that was going on in black communities in New York City. Banks writing off these neighborhoods, and no one at the state level enforcing the Community Reinvestment Act, which compelled banks to reinvest in these communities, to make loans available to homeowners and so forth. Nothing was done. But as far back as the early 80s, around like 1986, somewhere around there, and even earlier, I was writing about that. The bottom line is that those communities I was writing about in Jamaica, Queens, in Bedford-Stuyvesant, in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, in some parts of Manhattan, in South Bronx even, have systematically been emptied of their so-called undesirable populations. And new things are happening. You cannot get a building now, a home in Harlem, unless you're prepared to shell out a couple of million dollars. And that's because the real estate interests are very, very tight with City Hall. And it doesn't matter what the political persuasion is in City Hall. It doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican. Money talks, and they buy the cooperation, the political cooperation that they need to get things done. When we heard from the residents of Detroit, over and over again, we hear about the emptying of the city, forcible emptying, because foreclosures are a kind of economic weapon that the banks have used to systematically empty these neighborhoods, to cause people to lose their homes, to literally sink them into poverty. And you have it compounded by the surrounding decline that they have to live with. Factories holding up, jobs scarce, and so they become a pariah community. They're useless. They're not contributors, and that is how they're seen. So what do you do with these people? You make it very, very impossible for them to continue living there. They have to go someplace else. Where? That's not my problem. You would hear from City Hall, or you would hear from the state. That's not our problem. And so we see this being set in motion a long time ago. It didn't happen just yesterday. It didn't start on July the 18th. What then is the ultimate game plan? The ultimate game plan is just recoup, take, you know, as I said, you know, the basis of all nationhood is land. That's what people fight for, countries invading other countries. That's what they're fighting for, the land and everything on it and under it and over it and around it. Because land gives you a sense of statehood. The fight in Detroit is about land too. Let's get these undesirable people out of here. We will reclaim the land on which their deteriorating properties sit. We will bulldoze as fast as we can, as fast as we could condemn these buildings. We will bulldoze because we will say that, you know, it's a blight and it's a safety hazard, and we're doing this in the interest of safety. And then people would be fed up. Those who remain would be fed up or worn down psychologically about living surrounded by these conditions. And with the depletion of population, you get all the bad things that happen. You get an increase in crime. You get a devaluation of your already devalued home, if you're lucky enough to still hold on to one. You get schools that are shut down because the children aren't there. And even if they are, we won't keep schools open for them. We'll just force them someplace else. You go over there, send your children, you know, half a mile or 2 miles away, and that will solve that problem, which gives us a chance to retake the school and the land that the school sits on. I talked about this months ago, that the closing of schools is a part of this warfare that is being conducted. You shut down the schools, which is one of the main socializing elements in any community. So we should learn from Detroit. The stories that we have been told, the analysis that we have been afforded, we should understand that this is something in motion. This is not an isolated event. This is not something that exists in a vacuum. There are people planning what it is that they're going to do with Detroit after the main objective has been achieved. It's just like FEMA. FEMA actually has plans of what to do with our ashes in case, some major bomb is dropped and people are killed off. They already could tell what they need to do. Similarly, these forces that are coming together, and it's not just the Democrats versus the Republicans, they're all really, there's very little philosophical or ideological difference between these parties. They're anti-human. They're pro-corporate profits. And if they're going to please anybody, they will please the people with money. The people without money become inconvenient impediments to achieving the overall goal. Our president of the United States, Barack Obama, and his entire administration have been so, I don't know what the word is anymore. I've called them cowards, which they are. They're cowardly. They refuse to take brave stances in situations that call for logical responses. They have pledged their troth to the powerful, the corporate elite, the money elites, and they're doing their bidding. I have called, for example, Congressman Conyers' office several times asking for an interview. I've yet to get an answer. I'm told how busy he is. But in the face of this massive assault on his people, they're in his district, you get silence. I have not seen. Everybody got up there on January the 20th, and everybody's holding hands and singing, "We shall overcome." That ought to be changed to "We are overcome." They're singing out there, symbolically paying a tribute to Martin Luther King, but not having one-tenth of an ounce of his integrity. They have joined forces with these nefarious characters and corporations who have one thing and one thing only that they're interested in. Just remove all these excess people. They're no longer necessary. They're no longer relevant. And they basically are a drag. We shouldn't be carrying them. What is this? We're not some social welfare organization. We're about profits. We're about moving forward, they like to say. And these people, these are poor people, they are a drag. They are a drag on the forward thrust of our society. If they don't go away voluntarily, we will make it so that they will absolutely go away, because we will make them go away. I talked about the fact that across the country, the president's Secretary of Education has closed more schools than at any other period in the history of the United States. What does that mean? It means that the federal government at the highest levels is involved in the process of shutting down entire urban centers, increasing the pressure on poor people to just get fed up and move, even just for the sake of their children, move. And as they move, the whole new plan emerges about how to redesign the city with desirable elements. Just yesterday, we talked about Governor Snyder of Michigan putting a call out to the federal government to permit him to have new and different people coming into Michigan. These are professionals. These are tech people. These are people who could make the kind of living that could support the tax levied services that are demanded in the city of Detroit. In other words, he doesn't want anybody already there. He would prefer if they would just get up and go. But since they won't get up and go, let's import people, the people that we pick and choose, the people we think are going to be desirable. And let's, in the meantime, create enough a desperation on the part of others when they see, my God, you know, what's going to happen to me? The only jobs that are going to be available are going to be available to these professionals. Can you live there if you've been doing manufacturing work? Absolutely not. All the signs are telling us, using Detroit as an example, and it is happening all over the country, but all the signs are telling us that this plan of emptying these urban areas of its undesirable, that is to say, African American and Latino primarily populations, to get them out, force them to move, make their lives so miserable that they would just give up and go away. They don't care where you go, you just can't stay here, will be their mantra. Just get out. The plan for Michigan's Detroit is occurring even with a sizable African American and Latino representation, political representation. Because these people are so cowardly, for the most part. They're so without integrity. They don't have it in them to even put up a fight. one would think that with this situation going on, the big guns in the Democratic Party, the president himself would come to Detroit and organize a major summit of what is it that we need to get done here? How could we solve this problem before it becomes an issue? And insofar as it has become a problem, who's responsible? Is it in fact a real bankruptcy? Is it in fact the case that the city cannot pay its bills? But we have all these disparate tools being brought in, and they're all serving the grand purpose. The judge is going to rule, yes, you should apply for bankruptcy, and yeah, I could see why you need it because you owe this money. And you ask a simple question like, is that real? I've asked it here. Are these figures real? Has anybody certified that in fact Detroit cannot pay its bills? Has that been verified? Has it been subjected to some very close scrutiny, a basic thing like that? But you have a judge granting permission to declare bankruptcy who himself has no credible proof that, in fact, the city can't pay its bills. So you create an alternate narrative. You create this reality, a false reality, and people see the writing on the wall. They don't have to say, get out of town. They don't have to say, you better think about how you're going to live in the next 5 to 10 years because you won't be living here. They don't have to say, well, you know, you better check out what other alternatives there are for your children's education. They just shut down a school. That's your answer right there as to what your choices are, what you have to do next. So as we begin to discuss Detroit in this sense, today is just I'm giving you an overview of where we are going to be going in the next couple of weeks, because we will be hearing from other cities as to what's happening there. The idea is to connect these dots and to always keep in mind, you don't get finagled by this label called Democrat and that label called Republican. There's no difference. They're both dedicated to anti-human policies. They're both making life untenable for vast numbers of people. They're both engaging in a form of terrorism by holding people's lives, literally their lives in the balance, and doing so at the behest of a greedy, money-grubbing class of people and corporations that they're not satisfied with having a little. They want more. And when they want more, they get more, and then they want even more. And then you get even more, and then they want all. The realignment occurring in Detroit right now is the template for what will happen in every major city where you have sizable populations of African Americans and Latinos. And even with a significant representation in their various legislative bodies, whether it be at the state level or at the city level or at the local level, it would make no difference because they have no spine. They have no allegiances that can't be bought and paid for. This president is a disgrace. It's a harsh word, but I can't, you can't be kind here. It's not about being unkind either. It's about being factual. He's a disgrace. In office for 5 years now, and yet we see people screaming all over the country about how badly they're hurting. And he chooses to do these things that will get, big media attention and would show the people he wants to please how much he cares about them. I'm all for people caring about other people. But 5 years of an 8-year span in office with nothing really to stand on so far with respect to the specific and unique needs of the constituencies that put him there, I would say that that's an atrocious record. And I would say that that's disgraceful. And it is time, therefore, that in all these circumstances where people are similarly situated, they got to do some reorganizing of your political thinking. It is not surprising that time and again, Detroiters put in office people who just simply cannot and will not be effective. Time and again. Because they're so married to the Democratic Party. They can't live without a Democratic Party. Even though the Democratic Party could live without them, obviously. But they keep repeating this self-annihilating cycle. We put in office people who really cannot do the job or don't have the guts to do the job, who have no integrity, who have no particular allegiance to their hurting communities, and ultimately who have no sense of pride. Coleman Young has not yet been cloned in Detroit. Harold Washington has not yet been cloned in Chicago. We don't have people who can stand up at any level. You listen to Martin Luther King. I played this incredible speech on Monday that is seldom heard. Because it does have elements of his speech on why he opposed the war in Vietnam, but he was talking to religious leaders and they applauded in all the right places and whatnot. And guess what? They don't have an ounce of courage in them. There is no way this president could get away with half of what he has already done and even more so what he has not done. Because these folks go and they genuflect before him. He in turn genuflects before the people he needs to please. So black people, brown people, they're just cogs in a wheel. It has been determined that their usefulness has run out. They're no longer useful, nor are they necessary. And so the policy realignment is going to be occurring in big time all over the country. They're not going to wait to see what happens here. They know what's happening there because they engineered it. All over the United States, you'll see these urban centers experiencing exactly the same thing. And that's the lesson that we have to learn. I just wanted to open up with that today to plant in your minds that we will be talking about this and hopefully it will generate in everybody a certain sense of awareness, because this is not just theoretical stuff happening here. This, we are witnessing the destruction of life, of possibility, of opportunity, a deliberate effort to do grievous harm to people who don't deserve it. But it is also the responsibility of these folks who are being harmed to wake up and do politics very differently. Absolutely be ruthless and obsessive about your interests. I'm known for saying that for years. Ruthless and obsessive about your interests. Take no prisoners. Take them out. They're not doing what they're supposed to do. You take them out of office. Grow your own leadership. insist on controlling your square mile of turf. And you severely punish anybody who betrays you. That's your job. That's your task. This president has been a gross disappointment. And he will continue to be until he leaves office, because it's a whole different thing. I've talked about that. The entrepreneurial president who has been the hub of economic activity for everybody around him at the people's expense. You know, they tell you, well, we don't have money to do this or we don't have money to do that. They took a $10.5 billion loss on the bailout of GM. And they've subsidized Chrysler in its sale to Fiat. The government has actually subsidized the ownership by Fiat of Chrysler, and in the process lost $1.3 billion as well. At the same time, you're telling people that, you know, your children will have to go to another school because we're shutting down this one. And you don't have electricity because we've got to pay the bank. You know, these are the things that we're talking about as the so-called most powerful nation in the world. So I wanted to say that to you today. We are going to be continuing this discussion, and we will be focusing on using this template of Detroit, trying to understand it as much as we possibly can, because we will be called upon wherever we live to do something different and to exercise leadership in doing something different. Because this is, it looks like a court case, it looks very theoretical, but this, my friends, is open warfare. This is war being waged on the poor and working class folks. So I'll open up after this little break, 888-874-4888, and let's hear what you have to say right after this. A little bit more of the music. Thank you. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Yatrice Lead. Your calls and comments at 888-874-4888. Shelby from Louisiana, you're on the air.
Hey, Sister Latrice, how you doing?
I'm good, Shelby. Thank you.
That's wonderful. Thanks a lot. You know, I'm glad that you provided solutions because, and I really wanted your guest yesterday to tell us what we could do, because sometimes if we hear people talk about problems after problems after problems, it can be a very depressing kind of experience. And unless you see, because no one told me where I could call, what website I could go to, where could I donate. I didn't get any of that yesterday. Maybe I missed it, you know, but I'm into telling me what's the root cause of a problem, tell me the problem, and give me some possible solutions how I can get involved. That seems to be what I want to hear when we discuss problems that we have. You have to give me something that I can do. Otherwise, right. I hear this problem. So today you provided some good solutions. Now, may I say this? I want to, just the last thing I want to say is I have a notion called turning the tables. And what I mean by turning the tables, you know, a lot of black people tell me that they did this to me because I was black. But I turn the tables on it and I say they didn't do that to you because you're black. They did that to you because they're white or non-black. You see, because when you state it that way, you put the burden on the perpetrators and not the victims.
Hello? Well, we'll be talking about solutions, but okay. All this time, like I said, since last year, we've been talking about trying to define the problem in its many manifestations.
Okay.
And it's time now, because what I was hoping to do is to link up people all over the place to see what they have in common, where they live, with what is going on in Detroit, and perhaps they can, you know, in solidarity with those who are struggling and fighting in Detroit, they can form something of a network of, you know, educating each other. Look, you know, the labor movement has to do it, I think, too. The unions and so forth, they have to do the same thing because this is big.
But
I want to move on, though, Shelby, because we have a whole bunch of folks.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Thank you
so much for calling. Thank you. Leonard, you're on the air. Leonard from Brooklyn.
Oh, yes. I just called to mention how you talk about the false narrative. I was looking at a show on cable. It was about technology, and the show was called TransLogic. And the guy, he was out in Detroit, and they were showing how they have urban planners, and they're mapping out how they're going to redo the transportation system out there in Detroit and install all kinds of technology. So I said to myself, well, at the same time, they were saying in the news that Detroit is going bankrupt. But now you see this information coming out saying, well, they have urban planners there transforming it with, or going to transform it with all this new technology. So I put two and two together and say, well, they know what they're doing. They have a plan, and like you said, they just want certain people out.
Just get out. Whatever the benefits are to this newly reimagined Detroit, it's not meant for everybody to enjoy.
It's not meant for everybody. It's meant for this rich technical class.
Desirable people.
Yeah. So I just called I see the same thing going around. Yeah, I'm in Crown Heights area, you know.
Oh, my. Back in the 70s, I did a series, a five-part series called Crown Heights, A Lull Before the Storm.
Mm-hmm.
And it it was on the money in every single way. Even I am stunned by, you know, what it is I was able to determine from that.
Yeah,
thank you,
yeah.
Leonard, for calling. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to George from Baltimore. You're on the air, George.
Hey, Idris.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. I've emailed you, but this is my first live and in living color, so to speak. Hey, talking about Detroit, I think everybody listening should get the January 27th, 2014 copy of the New Yorker and read about one of the chief antagonists of a viable, vital Detroit by the name of L. Brooks Patterson, who is an unapologetic Detroit basher. He says, "I love sprawl," to quote him. He has no interest in seeing Detroit remain a vital, living city, and he certainly has no interest in making sure that people of color survive and thrive. So, again, get a copy of that New Yorker and read all about this joker. He's not very Detroit-friendly. Thanks, Utrice. I think
Thank
it's
you.
Courageous, and I will continue to listen and learn.
Me too. Thank you so much. Thanks. From Maryland, Madhu, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrice.
Hello.
I agree with what you're saying 100%. But I'm trying to figure out, you know, on my phone, I listen at Detroit Radio.
Yes.
I know people in Detroit. I've looked at Facebook of people in Detroit. I don't see any fire coming out of those people that supported Coleman Young. And I'm trying to figure out why. Because, you know, I have all this interest. I'm maybe 1,000 miles from Detroit. And I'm interested in what's going on there, you know, all over the country. As a matter of fact, all over the planet. But I'm just not getting one spark of fire coming out of anybody. I mean, I just don't see it. And I don't understand why.
The sparks are coming from the people who are bearing the brunt of these, you know, crazy-minded policies. We had two of them on just yesterday. They are working very, very hard. But, you know, they are part of the community that is most often attacked, and that is, you know, in the crosshairs of these policymakers. But, you know, there are resources available. And, again, I'm going to encourage the folks in Detroit. We'll have to set up a system where information is exchanged, and we could tell you where to go, like we just heard, you know, about the New Yorker magazine and so forth. Things that would give you a good fix on what it is that is happening there, but more so to begin the process of reinforcing people's struggles where they are. This is one of the important things that we have to do. Sometimes we think we are limited by geography. Well, that's happening in Detroit, and well, somebody there will be taking care of it. But when people who are fighting, like you heard just yesterday from Elena Herrada and from Abayomi Zikwe, when they are struggling, it really does help when people from the outside show in one way or the other that they are supporting their efforts. It really helps a great deal.
Right. I feel, you know, I absolutely support the struggle. But, I mean, even from the people that I know, intelligent people in Detroit, I don't get an email. I don't get anything about what's going on. And it seems like I'm this, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of miles away, and it seems like I'm more interested in what's going on with their situation than they are.
Right.
And that's really, you know, I don't understand why.
All right. Well, I mean, that's part of the situation too, is, you know, sometimes people just get so beaten down. They get so depressed about it. They don't even want to talk about it. So,
okay, well, I'm
going
to call in on Detroit Radio and try to start some sparks, and I'm going to report back what's happening.
Thank you. And you know, there are quite a few resources that I want to share with the audience, but I want to get them all together and put them up at the same time. Thanks so much for calling, Madhu.
Thank you.
We have Eric from Brooklyn. You're on the air.
Hey, Trace.
Hello.
I think this all relates. You know, I'll tie it into the Rodman situation, where it's too often, like you just said, you know, these politicians are shameful. These politicians are a disgrace, and these politicians don't stand up for anything. And this is reflected in the way that, you know, the rest of, you know, so many of our people are operating. Because, like, this, you know, this man and just called, like, the previous caller, why is it that so few people who see that they're being targeted refuse to change the way they're acting? Why is it that they refuse to change the way that they're voting? And this is, you know, at a certain point, you have to start, we have to start discussing that. You know, it's not enough that we discuss, you know, what is being done, when if there was a massive opposition to this, it couldn't go on so easily. It couldn't be so quick. You know, and this is
this is true. One of the things I had talked for years about is if they offend you in Buffalo, New York, you punish them in New York City, wherever you return the favor wherever you are, in solidarity with people who are suffering. So thanks
why,
a lot.
That's why I think, you know, it's so important that when we see the images of people who refuse to stand up for themselves, we have to challenge them. You have to stand up for yourself. You know,
well, yes, you do, and I would say no, you don't, because part of what happens in a struggle, you know, is a process of education. It takes time, and you don't want to beat up the very people that you want to engage. You educate rather than judge. So you have to bring them along, and you will have to make some kind of allowance for people who are just not ready, and for all kinds of reasons. You know, don't make a judgment. It's just that they're not ready where you meet them, and you just start working from there. Thanks a lot, Eric, for your call. And Jay, you have the last call, so you got to make it fast.
Well, first of all, Eutrice, I hope you have a beautiful weekend.
Thank you, Jay.
The reality is that we as a nation and as a people of color and other oppressed people have to realize that the rich have no concern whatsoever for our survival, and that we are going to have to figure out a way to collectively come together to beat off these type of attacks that are being placed against us, because like I've said from the beginning, this is only the test case for what's to come. And I don't see it getting any better. I see it getting worse, if the truth be told, because the more and more you do your investigation of this matter in Detroit, the more and more it seems as though there was no reason to go into bankruptcy if certain things were done, if there was the support from the Obama administration and from others around the nation in dealing with this. And the only person and the only people that will benefit from this in the long run will be the banks. And it seems like that's the only thing that matters to Obama is the banks, those who are his major backers that allowed him to get into office. So, I mean, I just hope we collectively figure out how we can come together to make a positive change for the better so that we could be here and survive.
Well, thank you for that. We'll be, of course, thanks, Jay, and you have a good weekend, too. This is, like I said, I'm going to be, it's not going to be on consecutive days. We'll do this as often as we can, but I really want to adopt this as a reason for people to re-examine their political priorities and also to look at how people are struggling on the other side of the coast, depending on where you are, whether East Coast or Midwest or wherever you are. that people are struggling. All people are struggling. All poor people are being, brutalized in Detroit. The interesting thing is that we have seen from our activists all kinds of people coming together. They have one thing in common, and they know that they're suffering, and there's no reason for them to be suffering like that. So all across the board, this is what is so instructive, that even though the issue is very, very huge as it looms in front of them, they're courageous. Elena Herrada is going to go to court. She has a court date because she's protesting. So we will find ways to convey to those people who are trying to do something and defend the community and defend working people and poor people to basically give them reason to continue their struggle with some degree of hope and solidarity. Thank you so much for listening today, and let's meet again next week at 1 o'clock Eastern Time. Please do pass the word around and let people know that this PRN-FM is your place to get information, and this is your special program, and turn other people on to it as well. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.